Hey everyone, welcome back.
Hello, hello. It's another Wink Wednesday.
Yeah, it is.
Oh my god, I just realized this is the second to last one for the season.
That's crazy. We're almost at the end.
I know. It's been a really... I feel like engaging is the best word to use. Yeah. I feel like it's been a really engaging past few months.
No, yeah, I definitely agree with that. I feel like each episode I'm learning so many new details about our criminal legal system and how it works mm-hmm. and the impacts that it has on people who are affected by
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah, but also like literally everybody is affected by it because what's happening to people on the inside to some extent impacts what's happening to people on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like honestly that's become even more evident to me as we continue engaging with people
yeah,
in this space more
definitely.
And more. So on that note, why don't we get started with today's episode? Fenella, take it away.
Okay, so today we actually have a variety of topics to talk about. We're going to be getting into the difficulties of navigating a lot of the jargon and legal procedures for people who don't have a lot of resources. And then we're also going to be talking about the criminalization of domestic violence and touch on wrongful convictions in America.
And to help us get into all of that, we got to speak with Eileen Marr for this episode. She is currently an activist with Vocal New York, advocating for better treatment and resources for incarcerated individuals. Eileen spent over 2 years incarcerated at Rikers, Bedford, and Albion for a crime that she never committed. And she shared with us her journey battling a system that failed to provide her any support or justice. I'm Bhavna.
And I'm Vendela. And this is Women's Health Incarcerated.
So Eileen, why don't you start us off by telling us a bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a local activist, I guess you would call it, working to end mass incarceration and hopefully repair what's going on the inside for people mm-hmm. to make their situations better. I'm a criminalized survivor of domestic violence. So I've been working on that for about 4 years now since I've been home.
So for more context, Eileen has been working with Vocal New York on several different projects, including one that's helping to change bail laws in New York, as well as one regarding discovery laws. She's also been a part of the Justice for Women Task Force, working on a project to move Rosie's off of Rikers Island.
In the Justice for Women Task Force, mm-hmm. we're trying to get Rosie's moved off of the island as quickly as possible. And right now, there's down from almost 1,000 women, there's 274. So it's almost the perfect opportunity to get them off of the island. The Bayview facility is being unused over on in Chelsea on 12th Avenue. And there's a couple others that are also, we have our eye on.
Mm-hmm. And Rosie's is the women's jail on Rikers, right? So would this new place still be considered a place of incarceration?
Well, technically they're not incarcerated, they're detained because they haven't been convicted yet. So it would be, but we don't want it to be what it is now.
Right.
We have pages and pages of different ideas to make it more of a women's center in a therapeutic setting.
Right. And that sounds very much needed. And it seems like a lot of your current work is centered on women, and I was wondering what drew you to focus your work on that.
Well, traditionally, the women in New York have kind of been, for lack of a better phrase, the redheaded stepchildren. The men who have a stronger advocacy base, they tend to get some of their things remedied much quicker mm-hmm. than the women do. And the women kind of got what was left over. A lot of focus is made on the men because there are more of them. But being that women are the backbone of every community, it's
yeah.
not only about them being in the facilities, it's about preventing them from entering the facilities.
So I actually want to take a minute to emphasize what Eileen is saying here. The fact that women are the backbone of every community because I find that so important. Mm-hmm. And I know that we've already talked about this on Wink in other episodes, but many incarcerated women are mothers who also happen to be the primary caregivers in families. And I feel like, Venela, that definitely goes into what you were saying earlier about how incarceration impacts not only the people on the inside, but also the people on the outside too, you know, like in families.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to get at earlier. The downstream effects of incarceration are enormous. And also, when you think about this even more, even the fact that majority of women, I think it's like over 60% who are incarcerated.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, over 60% who are incarcerated have a history of sexual and or physical abuse prior to incarceration. Mm-hmm. That fact comes to mind because then we have to consider the ways in which trauma can play a role before, during, and after incarceration, and how that in turn can affect the ways in which women interact in their communities and families. Right. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense for sure.
Yeah, and I actually do want to bring the conversation back to Eileen's story specifically, because earlier she did mention that she was a criminalized survivor of domestic violence herself, and that actually makes me think more about what this criminalization looks like.
Like, for example, when survivors are prosecuted for fighting back against their abuser, mm-hmm. or, you know, when they're arrested for crimes that they were forced into by their abuser. Things like that, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah, and Eileen goes into the details of that more, so let's hand it back to her.
There's many kinds of criminalized survivors of domestic violence. There's people who fight back, and they wind up prosecuted for, in the most extreme cases, murder. There's the abusive partners that have forced women to participate in criminal activities, or vice mm-hmm. versa, because there's men out there that have taken the bullet for things women have done, mm-hmm. too.
Definitely. Did you know of others who were incarcerated because they were criminalized for domestic violence?
There were so many right. women that are at Bedford now for physically fighting back. So there has to be some change in that as well. I'm not saying people should abuse self-defense, but if it's clearly self-defense, someone shouldn't be prosecuted and locked away because they chose to protect themselves or their family. I know of one woman that had an order of protection against her ex, and she fended him off with a lamp, one of those big old ceramic lamps, and she wound up getting arrested. But he who violated the order of protection didn't. So there's definitely some gender bias mm-hmm. in that respect as well. I think
So these cases that Eileen is referring to are often because of mandatory arrest policies that result in the dual arrest of both the abuser and the victim. Or, you know, sometimes even solely just the victim in a domestic violence situation. And we actually touched on this a little in season one. I think it was episode 10, the one with Professor Michelle Jacobs. But essentially, in situations where police do not identify a quote-unquote primary aggressor, they may arrest both the abuser and the victim. Or even as Eileen mentioned, they may arrest only the victim who was just acting in self-defense.
In my situation, it was a theft crime that was committed by somebody else that I had previously been in a relationship with, but I was arrested for it and blamed for it. Had I implicated him, they were threatening me with conspiracy, which carries a mandatory minimum of 15 years in prison. I had a bail of $75,000 because they claimed I was a flight risk, which was just a blatant lie that the ADA had told in court. I was kind of backed into a corner with, in the beginning, very poor legal help, but coupled with being stuck on Rikers Island for over a year, I made a decision to take a plea so I could be home or go mm-hmm. home. So I took a 2-6 and I was home within a year.
So it sounds like Eileen received very little help from the start. She was wrongly convicted and then received no help or support to get out of the situation, and ultimately had to plead guilty so that she could receive what sounds like a much smaller sentence than she could have gotten had she tried to get her ex-partner, who was the actual culprit, implicated.
Right. So basically, Eileen had next to no options than to be sentenced for a crime that she didn't commit. And the way that she described it was feeling like being backed into a corner.
The way they back people up into a corner is they basically park them in the county or on Rikers Island. I mean, there's been people who have waited for trials for over 7 years. And they take you back and forth to court. You go to court for the day. Nothing happens. You got to go back. And they do it. For me, I was going every month to court, but nothing was really happening. And that's what happens to many people. Sometimes they'll go and they won't see a judge at all, or see their attorneys, or their attorneys won't show up. There's a whole myriad of different stall tactics that they use to frustrate you. So they basically just keep finding ways to delay your case. So you're sitting on Rikers Island or in the county and getting more and more frustrated. And the time keeps passing that you're away from home. So like I said, how do I get home? And my lawyer said, well, you're going to have to take a plea because the judge isn't going to let you off. And that's the quickest way to get home. If I had gone to trial, they were going to drag that out. Sometimes I think I'd still be sitting there 8 years later if I had gone to trial, especially since I had a very difficult judge. And in the middle of, after I took my plea, he was at the age of forced retirement about a year or so later. So I would have been caught in that where I would have had to wait for a new judge and just keep dragging things out. So I took 2 to 6, which is 2 years on the bottom and 6 years at the maximum.
And Eileen, you were convicted of this crime that your ex-partner actually committed. And I think that you had mentioned this a little earlier in the interview, but at the time that this was all happening, he was on the other side of the country and you were completely unaware of, you know, his involvement in all of this. So I was wondering, how did you end up figuring out that he was the one who did it?
When I was first arrested for it, I was ROR'd. I wasn't put in jail. So I was home for a few more months. So during that time, I started doing my own investigating, and that's how, when I found out everything that had happened. Then in October, I was indicted by a secret grand jury, and that's how I wound up getting the $75,000 bail and going to jail because we didn't have it.
All right, let's just actually take a moment here and unpack some of the terminology that Eileen has been using here.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so why don't you, Vanilla, take care of what ROR is in more detail, and then I'll come in with more information on what a grand jury is.
Sure. Okay, so in case y'all are unfamiliar with it, the acronym ROR stands for Released on Your Own Recognizance, and it's basically no cost bail. So when an individual is released on their own recognizance, they're promising to show up to court as required, but there's no bail that needs to be paid. But a judge may still place certain restrictions on the individual, like requiring them to check in with the probation officer.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of what a grand jury is, it's when witnesses and even documents with subpoenas are summoned to a group of 16 to 23 grand jurors. And these proceedings are essentially held in secret, so the person who is being accused isn't even aware that they're going on, and they aren't given the opportunity to testify or explain themselves. There's also no judge that presides. It's actually the prosecutor that is leading the entire proceedings.
You have the right afterwards to request a new one, and I did, but it fell on deaf ears. I filed so many motions in the court for that. For bail hearings or a new ADA, because I had found out when I was home on the ROR that whether it's true or not, the victim in my case claimed she was friends with the DA that was prosecuting my case, the ADA, and that their families were friends. So I filed a complaint against him like 20 times and it fell on deaf ears. So whether it was true or not, it really didn't matter because one of my attorneys said, well, it's probably not true. I said, that doesn't matter. She's already put a seed of doubt in my mind by saying it. But nobody paid mind to that.
So Eileen got arrested on theft charges and was released on her own recognizance, which allowed her to go home. And that's when she discovered that her ex-partner was actually the one who committed the crime.
However, she was indicted by a grand jury who set a high bail for $75,000 because she was considered to be a flight risk. This was an amount that she could not afford, so then she had to go to Rikers Island and await a trial.
If Eileen had mentioned her ex-partner's responsibility for this crime, she could have been charged with conspiracy and been sentenced with a mandatory minimum of 15 years.
So essentially, she was forced into taking a plea, meaning she had to admit that she did this act that she never did, and then serve a 2 to 6 year sentence. So, Eileen, did you feel like you had anyone on your side to support you through this?
I mean, other than my family and some friends, not really from the court and the justice system. No, not at all. Mm-hmm. There are not as many agencies that assist women either. So that's another drawback, like the alternatives to incarceration and the programs such as that.
For listeners, basically, when Eileen did try to find resources to help her out in this situation, they had these alternatives to incarceration programming going on, which she was hoping to get into. And if she got into it, she would be able to go home on a lower felony and comply with probation for that. And then for this program, there are different agencies that supervise people's alternatives to incarceration, meaning that they would make reports to court and other stuff like that. But unfortunately, in Eileen's case, she was unable to find a supervising agency that her judge would approve of and was unable to be a part of this kind of programming.
Which, again, shows how much your experience with the system is subjective and dependent on who you're stuck with as your judge. And if you're poor, then who you have assigned to you as a lawyer.
It was difficult because I had lawyers that didn't want to cooperate. So like my motions would fall on deaf ears and so forth and so on.
And Eileen was forced to navigate the system with little help and wasn't in a place where she could afford quality legal services. In general, this is an issue that a lot of people with not a lot of resources face.
Right. Like, the way our legal system currently functions, it definitely disproportionately affects lower-income people. You know, even with things like incredibly high bail that force people to sit in jail awaiting trial. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, the median bail amount for felonies is $10,000, which represents 8 months of income for a typical person detained because they can't pay bail.
And this can actually even force individuals to take plea bargains in order to have a reduced sentence, especially if they've been waiting for so long in jail and inevitably feel impatient or helpless, which is also something that we literally saw in Eileen's case.
Both, but a lot of the attorneys wouldn't speak to me because you needed to have money. And that was the problem. And initially, I thought my attorney was okay. But the minute I went to jail, she just started pushing me to take a plea. I spent a lot of time in the law library.
What was your experience like at Rikers?
Well, it's not a good experience. I was lucky in the fact that maybe because I was a little bit older than some of the other ladies and more knowledgeable about the court systems and things such as that, that I was looked to for a lot of advice. And I got along with everybody. I didn't get involved with the drama or the fighting or anything like that. So on that level, things went smoothly. The officers, for the most part, I got along with, but they're still horrible people. That was the only, every day they would find some way to tell us we were not real people, we were less than human.
So I kind of want to switch gears a bit and talk a little bit more about the fact that you were involved in this domestic violence situation, and almost immediately after that, you were starting to get involved with the legal system and facing incarceration and whatnot. So what kind of impact did that have on you? Because it sounds like you didn't have too much time at all to process everything that was going on. Were there any resources available to you to help you with that?
There's very little resources for domestic violence. There's, of course, the shelters and the hotlines and things, but they only have but so much room to help people. So I only had basically like a year and some change in between the two incidents of him leaving and then going away that I was kind of free and on my own. So that was very frustrating because I really didn't have much actual freedom. So
would you actually be comfortable with talking a bit more about that sense of frustration? What was it that you were thinking about during that time? And when you looked back at how short the space you had was in terms of the freedom you were experiencing, what do you feel?
Well, once he left and left the area, I was, there was a very calm sense of relief that I was slowly getting more comfortable with. And then a few months later, when the arrest happened and everything, even though it was just something I didn't do, there was still a lot. It brought all that anxiety back.
Right.
So those 3 months of an ROR were, it was like a pre-incarceration because the anxiety was so much, and it was basically like being back to when he was around. But instead of being anxious about what was going to happen with him, I was anxious about going to prison.
Yeah, it sounds like you were feeling almost trapped in a sense.
Yeah, because I didn't know what was going to happen. I wasn't sure. My lawyer was saying one thing, but then my gut was telling me something else. So I wasn't, that actually made me even more anxious, I should say.
And what was going through your head when you finally realized that you were going to be incarcerated?
Well, when it was made clear that that was what was going to happen, I was angry. I was angry at, I was angry at my attorney who really didn't fight for me in that moment when the DA was lying.
And can you actually clarify what he was lying about?
He said I was a flight risk, that I had said I had property in another country, which if I don't even own property in this country. And he told the court I had property in another country and that I had said I was going to run. None of that happened.
So what was the reasoning behind that?
So he could get a high bail based on the fact that I was a flight risk.
But does he not need to present adequate proof to show that you have property in another country?
No, not with that judge.
When you were experiencing that sense of like anger and rage and just feeling frustrated at the fact that no one was helping you in the situation, how did you manage to cope and come to terms with this reality that you were going to be in prison?
I had no choice. Even looking back, I realized I had no choice. So I had to muddle through and do the best that I could so I could get out, because the other options weren't really there for me. I did not want to sit on the island for 8 years fighting a case that might have been a losing battle.
Right.
I realized that they were going to bleed time out of me no matter what. So at least I was going to do it comfortably and get home as quickly as possible and get it over with so I could move on. like I had said, I didn't get involved in the drama, so I got along fairly well with everybody. So that did make things a little bit better. And I was able to really just concentrate on what I had to do to get home.
Were you scared?
Never.
Wow. Did you have any prior knowledge of what incarceration was going to look like before you had to go through it yourself?
Yeah, I did. I had, when I worked in foster care for all those years, I spent a fair amount of time in many of the facilities in on Rikers Island and Brooklyn House and upstate, the prison facilities with children visiting their parents or whatever. I spent time not only just visiting, but talking with the parents, because I always made it my business to even work with the parents to get their kids back when they got out, which isn't the most popular thing to do, but I did do that. And I had a knowledge of what it would be like on the inside. The only thing that that made me anxious was my life on the outside. My business, my apartment at the time, and I was very anxious overall, and you know, family and friends and everything. I was anxious overall at that, but not scared.
I remember when we were doing the interview itself and she mentioned that she was never scared. I don't know why, but that really stood out to me.
Me too. Even hearing about the extent to which she was anxious and also about her going through this abusive relationship like she did and then feeling free for what literally seemed like a few minutes in the grand scheme of things.
Right, yeah.
And then suddenly having that freedom snatched away again.
Yeah, and for something that she had no direct involvement in. And still, she had this tone of, I want to say determination in her voice, which is incredible. And I think it's a pattern that I'm noticing with all of the women that we've spoken to so far.
Definitely. The determination and the patience is very apparent. And also what Eileen feels about the system itself is pretty familiar too. And I feel like that also says a lot.
I think the system is just broken. I think it's classist and racist and at times gender biased. Like I noticed that a lot of the women are held on that, well, you should have known better type of, there's no excuse mentality. If you don't have money or some kind of, I guess, societal prestige, you're gonna fall at their mercy.
All right, so before we sign off, y'all probably know the drill by now, but it's time to get into some icebreakers. Cue the music.
So Eileen, to start us off with our very first question, what are some of your simple day-to-day pleasures?
I always start the day off listening to the Beastie Boys and the Ramones. I like mostly 70s punk rock and things like that. So that always helps me get my day going.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So what other artists do you like?
Well, a lot of the, you know, of course, the Talking Heads, Blondie, Sex Pistols, The Clash, The Damned, Television, The Runaways, all that type of stuff.
You're taking us real old school.
I don't like modern music.
That's valid.
That's fair enough. I feel like there's a lot of electronic stuff happening in modern music.
It's definitely very different.
After the 90s, I was kind of done with it.
Yeah. So the second question that we have for you is, what is invisible but you wish people could see? So this could be anything like, you know, atoms or like the feeling of love or something that's just really abstract, but you wish it wasn't abstract.
Sometimes air.
Hmm.
I'd like to see what the oxygen looks like.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That would be pretty cool if we were just walking around and we actually like are able to see something all around us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it would be really telling of, you know, where there's air pollution and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right. And for our third and, well, for our last question, what is a quote or life philosophy that you've been really resonating with recently?
Oh, Injustice Anywhere is a Threat to Justice Everywhere by Dr. King.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's one of my favorite quotes.
Yeah.
Reminds me of my own situation. It reminds me of things going on with the police brutality issues that are going on, the schisms between the financial classes. Mm-hmm. I think it applies to so many different
Definitely.
Things.
Definitely. That's a really powerful quote. And it's so relevant to how the criminal legal system works now and all of the work that people are doing to restructure it.
Yeah. And it's also very telling that something that was said so long ago is still pretty applicable to where we are right now.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think that about wraps up our questions for you, Eileen. Thank you so, so much for coming on the show. This was such a great conversation. And I feel like we actually got to cover so many different topics, which was amazing. And we really just appreciate you taking the time to share a bit of your narrative with us. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode. Next week, we'll be releasing the final episode of the season, and we're going to be talking about the concept of time and how it's experienced while incarcerated. Until then.
Women's Health Incarcerated can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. To view our transcripts, learn more information about the intersection between the incarceration system and healthcare, or find different ways that you could get involved, please visit www.winkthemovement.org. That's www.whincthemovement.org.